The student works of great composers often revealed the greatness that was to come later in their lives. This is Student Composer of the Month, where we talk about anything and everything with composers who study or have recently studied in the greater Baltimore area, here on WBJC.com. I'm John Search, and I am in the studio with Elliot Graybill, who was recently a student at Peabody Conservatory. And Elliot, why don't you tell me more about where you have studied composition?
Well, I'm Elliot Graybill, and I went to University of Virginia. That's when I started. Actually, I started before that. I've been writing music since about age 15. I started taking private lessons when I lived in Indiana. I'm actually from Maryland, but I lived in Indiana for about 3 years.
Cool.
And I had a really great teacher who spent a lot of time with me, and we just listened to music, and you know, he really taught me what I needed to know. And then I moved back to Baltimore when I was in high school, and I actually started taking lessons at the Peabody Preparatory with Stephen Cox.
Cool.
I went to UVA. University of Virginia has a really great computer music program.
Interesting.
So that's, I do a lot with electronics in my music. And so University of Virginia, there's Judith Shaton, Matthew Burtner are both composers there. And they kind of taught me to open up my mind to consider writing for more than just instruments, but also to consider sound in my work as well, and coming up with new sounds and that, you know, that people have never heard before.
Maybe expanding the definition of what an instrument could be.
Correct. Yes.
So you said you started composing at age 15 and then you started taking lessons. What was the motivating factor in your desire to compose and then your desire to study it seriously?
I think that music is, to me, all about emotion. That's why I write music. When I'm feeling sad, I often create better work than when I'm feeling happy. And when you're in high school, you know, you're kind of invisible. You're kind of a social outcast. No one ever really listened to me all that much. So I felt that it would be easier to, you know, write down my feelings in the form of music.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
And then when you decided to start taking composition lessons, what was the point where you perhaps heard it was a possibility to study this as a real academic pursuit?
From the very beginning, I listened to composers. I loved classical music from when I was very young because my parents got me when I was young.
So the first music that you composed was in the classical style.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. I don't really mind. I don't really care whether I end up in an academic job or if I'm kind of a freelance composer. Mm-hmm. I almost like the second a little bit more.
Yeah. I guess what I'm going for is, because, for example, when I started to sing, I didn't immediately think about taking voice lessons. Mm-hmm. But when you started composing in the classical style, you knew that, you know, it would be a good idea to have a teacher to help you along doing
that.
Well, that's good. What was the teacher that you, what would you say you got from teachers in high school when you were composing then?
I think just a very, you know, a strong groundwork. It's interesting. I think that writing music in the classical style does take a little bit of study because unlike rock and roll where you have, you know, verse, refrain, mm-hmm. classical music has a much freer form. Yeah, so when I studied with Brad Bodine when I lived in West Lafayette, Indiana, it was the very beginning.
Right.
And when I went to Stephen Cox in Peabody, that was a really interesting experience because it was the first time someone ever performed my music. Mm-hmm. And whenever you have a a premiere, I guess, it's always kind of a roller coaster. You never know what's going to happen exactly.
Right.
And but at the same time, it's also very rewarding because then you've got a CD or a recording that you can take home and listen to, and it's being played by a real person. And, you know, I'll go back to recordings I made years ago that I haven't listened to since, and I'll listen to it with fresh ears, and I'll be like, oh my gosh, that's really cool. How did I come up with that?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll use it in a new piece.
Cool. And then you decided to come back for grad school to Peabody Conservatory after you finished at UVA. What influenced that decision?
Well, I spent a long time actually out of UVA in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to know the world a little bit more. You know, you're very sheltered in academia. It's really nice while you're there. It's kind of an oasis.
Right.
But I was a math teacher,
mm-hmm.
and that was nice because I had summers off to write.
Cool.
And I had a lot. Being in the real world where you have responsibility and people depend on you, it is kind of an emotional roller coaster that I wanted. I don't know if I wanted to experience it, but it was something that provided inspiration for me and also taught me that, you know, not a lot of people in the real world really listen to classical music, and
yeah.
I need to do something. If I'm going to be a composer, I need to figure out a way of writing music that relates to people. Not that there's anything wrong with art for art's sake. You know,
mm-hmm.
I have a whole spectrum of you know, stuff. Some of it's from art to art's sake, and then some of it's our crowd pleasers. I think composers should do both.
That seems to be a motion or a movement that some composers, a lot of composers, I would say, are taking now that we are into the 21st century and looking back at 20th century music and how so much of it was really for the composer's community,
mm-hmm.
and not as much for the audience. I see a movement in more of a direction of realizing that there is an audience to be written for, and I think composers are doing a good job of that.
Oh, yeah, especially here in Baltimore, where you have, you know, the Peabody Conservatory, obviously.
Right.
What, 600 concerts a year?
Something like that.
And then you've got, you know, the Symphony, Meyerhoff, Marin Alsop, BSO. But then you have these interesting underground concerts,
yeah.
At the Copycat Building, at the Cork Factory.
Mm-hmm.
In Baltimore, you have these houses that look just like normal row houses. And then you go in and you realize instead of three stories, it's actually four. And then there's an attic on top. And then it goes deep, into the block. And so you have these people with these giant parlors.
Full of surprises.
And they host concerts there, and it's different from classical music in the past, where you'd go into a sterile concert hall and you have to sit down and not move around, and you have to clap between certain things but not other times.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas these are very intimate settings where you're at someone's house and, you know, someone's serving food and beverage, and you get to kind of talk with people before and after.
It's interesting that you say that, because one could argue that this is actually, with the parlor setting of music, this is actually getting back to the way it was done, say, in the 19th century with, say, Rossini's musical soirees or Schubert's, I forget what the concert, like the Schubertiad concerts, the Schubert House concerts or something
yeah.
like that, and or like where, you know, music was premiered in parlors and in taverns, tavern mm-hmm. music, and these were all, you know, classical composers premiering their works. And I think we might be getting back to where music was premiered in houses that were able to be filled. And it's odd that this is also a deviation from the 20th century, because I think music in the 20th century, you had the people who went to concerts, which were put on in these large symphony halls, that gave classical music this kind of, I think, kind of unnecessary high-class nature to it that alienated a lot of what the potential audience could be. And then on the other end, you had the art that would not have appealed to those concert-going audiences because it was too complicated, that the people who were going to be a status symbol, they would not have appreciated the music that composers were putting out in the middle of the 20th centuries. It was like the audience and the composers were just running at a parallel just for such a long time. It was a musical asymptote.
There are a lot of things that have contributed to the downfall of classical music.
Well, it hasn't fallen all the way down yet.
I would say
it's coming back up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things. I think that I have some theories here. Mm-hmm. Who knows if they're true or not. I don't have any backup observations. Please feel free to fact check.
Well, let's hear one of them and then get to some of your music.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that there was a time when music was written to appeal to people of all ages.
Mm-hmm.
So old people, young people, middle-aged people, children, some musical genres like country blues were appealed to old people more than they appealed to young people.
Mm-hmm.
And swing, big band, jazz, I think was more, it seems like they were both designed for both old people and young people. And the moment the records, because if you ask your grandparents, none of them are going to say, were the people who are older than you talking bad about swing dance like it was something that these young people are crazy. They didn't talk that because it appealed to everyone. And
right.
I think the moment the record companies realized that, if we can make more money by appealing to just young people, that was one of the things that caused that, that kind of caused a divide in,
Right. That sort of music being kind of a youth movement was something that record companies saw as profitable.
Yeah. Of course, now there are no record stores anymore.
Right.
And that's not just a downfall of classical music. That's a downfall of music.
Right.
So the whole music industry is struggling.
And you have fewer and fewer schools teaching music.
Mm-hmm.
And there are schools in Baltimore that don't have music programs.
Oh, yeah.
Even with such a music community that Baltimore has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there are still people who are playing music. There are people who will always stick with it, whether there's music schools or not, whether there are jobs or not, whether there are record companies or not. People are always going to do it. They're going to find a parlor in Baltimore, and people will play for each other.
And I'm totally for that business model where we play music for people who are able to come see it, and we put it on in a way that it's going to fill the house of whatever size.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's get to some of your music. And what do you want to play for us first?
Well, let's play Lake Pontchartrain.
All right.
This is for string sextet.
And who are the performers on this recording?
We have six local Peabody musicians, Nicholas Benz and Chris Champoli are on violin.
It's funny. Nicholas Benz was the previous month's student composer of the month.
No kidding.
And I've been talking with Chris Champoli about being the one after you.
Awesome.
So,
yeah.
So even composers playing on other composers' works.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So Nick Benz, Chris Champoli. Then we have Jasper Zintek on viola, as well as Andrew Gu on viola. And then on cellos, we have Mauricio Gallego and Rene Delgado.
All right. And this is the String Sextet Lake Pontchartrain by Elliot Grable.